This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about vulnerabilities in power meters. And we talked to Lenley Henseling from Aerospike, talking about real-time decision data systems. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 549, recorded June 23rd, 2023. Aerospike's real-time data platform. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Melissa. More than 10,000 clients worldwide rely on Melissa for full spectrum data quality and ID verification software. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. And by Miro. Miro is your team's online workspace to connect, collaborate, and create together. Tap into a way to map processes, systems, and plans with the whole team. Get your first three boards for free to start creating your best work yet at Miro.com/podcast. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide to the big world of the enterprise. I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals and the experts. Starting with our very own principal analyst at IMD, he's the man who has the pulse of the enterprise, and he's always, always, always busy. Mr. Curtis Franklin, welcome back to the show, Kurt. So what's keeping you busy this week?
Oh, there's too much keeping me busy. I'm trying to get ready to head out doing a little bit of vacationing over the next week or two. So obviously, as all of us know, that means that this week has been slammed. Lots of stuff going on. Published something new on Omdia.com for our subscribers. Also had something new on DarkReading.com and had to write a couple of things that will be up on Dark Reading over the next week or two. So plenty to keep me busy and lots to look forward to. I get back to a busy, busy remainder of July and August.
For being here, especially during your busy season. Well, we also, you know, lots to look forward to. I was looking forward to having Mr. Kurtz and Mr. Brian G back on the show. Brian, welcome back to the show. What's keeping you busy this week?
Packing. I'm getting ready to actually go on a cruise in Alaska. So big change of temperature, but ought to be fun. That, and I'm trying to go and revive a whole bunch of surveillance cameras. Seems people made some changes and it broke. So I need to fix things. A lot of fun though.
Well, speaking of busy, there has been a lot going on in the enterprise this week, so we should definitely get started with that. USB drives are spreading spyware again because we know, you know, they're kind of happening a lot. And as China's Mustang Panda APT is actually going global there, so we'll talk about that. Plus, our guest today, Lenley Henseling, he's Chief Product Officer of Aerospike. He needs to talk about real-time data platforms with massive parallelism and performance and a surprisingly small server footprint. So we'll definitely talk about that. Lots coming up. But before we do, since there's a ton of stuff happening in the enterprise, we should jump into this week's news blips. Amazon has announced a $100 million investment in a new program that's actually focused at AWS Generative AI in their innovation center, aiming to head and stay ahead of the competitive AI landscape. According to this TechCrunch article, the mission is to expedite enterprise innovation with generative AI. Now, the initiative brings together AWS affiliated data scientists, strategists, engineers, and solution architects with clients and partners. And it aims to actually encourage customers to dream big, dream up use cases that can bring maximum value to their business, leveraging that generative AI technology. But the funding will fuel, quote, people, technology, and processes around generative AI, assisting AWS clients to ideate, design, and roll out new generative AI products and services. Now, the center will help customers build a roadmap around generative AI, focusing on use cases aligned with business value, developing proof of concept solutions, and of course, scale as well. Now, the center will kickstart its activities with clients who have previously contacted AWS, showing an interest in this technology. It mainly aims to support sectors like financial services, healthcare, and life sciences, media, and entertainment, and much more. Now, its race in the AI arena, not long ago, AWS launched a program called AI Startups and unveiled Bedrock, a platform for generative AI-powered platforms and apps. But would this be enough to beat the competitive and competition from Google Cloud and Microsoft? And the AI market expected to reach nearly $110 billion by 2030, a large enough for multiple players. Question is, right? AI-focused investment is growing, and Salesforce and Workday are also committed to milestones and millions to AI startups. Amazon's entry adds to the escalating arms race among tech giants to claim AI dominance. Is Amazon too late, or will there be new initiatives to turn the tides?
So it's an open secret in the cybersecurity industry that most customers are overwhelmed by the number of security tools that are available and the number of security tools they've already deployed. There's too much complexity, too many signals of compromise, and too many options for how to deal with the issues. All of that may be why a survey published this week by OpenText shows that the vast majority, that's 86%, of small to mid-sized business customers using managed security service providers are aiming to reduce their current portfolio of security tools. In an article at Dark Reading, Jeff Bibby, Senior Vice President at OpenText Cybersecurity, is quoted as saying, "Consolidation is twofold. Businesses are going to service providers because they don't have the staffing or financial resources to purchase and manage multiple tools. And from the service provider perspective, fewer tools and fewer vendors mean simplified billing and greater ease of doing business," end quote. Now, this consolidation isn't something that's brand new. By mid-2022, when 83% of companies predicted a downturn this year, three-quarters of companies plan to reduce the number of security vendors they used. That was up from 29% in 2020. That's something that's similar to what Gartner has reported seeing. In their reports, most mid-size enterprises, those are firms with $50 million to $1 billion in revenue, up to 2,500 employees, are looking to reduce the number of vendors. But rather than doing it because they're focusing on consolidation, their companies are looking to optimize their security operations. Now, according to Gartner, two-thirds of these mid-size enterprises are pursuing security vendor reduction strategies, while the remaining third have delayed consolidation but will likely simplify their security within the next 3 years. And while pretty much every company wants to simplify its processes and save money, those savings can be tough to come by. Because what you wind up having to do is learn a new product, a new solution, and people have to get trained on it, so companies have to modify their processes. And modification, as we know all too well, takes time and, well, lots of money. Sometimes, it seems, small to mid-sized companies just can't win.
Now, I'm going to summarize this Dark Reading article. And reality is, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about one of the dirty little secrets of building automation. So this article happens to be about the Schneider Electric Ion system, and it's complaining about login credentials being sent in clear text. Now, I need to point out, it is not the only smart meter that does this. When I was doing a lot of work with the GE meters, those are doing the exact same thing. In reality, the default is no password at all. What bothers me a bit is that quite a few implementations of the IEEE 1588/Modbus TCP/IP gateways aren't encrypted, even though the protocol for many manufacturers have that ability, which is why so many enterprise smart meter installations are on isolated networks. Well, the good news is that most Zigbee and LoRa implementations, which are superseding a lot of the IEEE 1588 installations, start off using encrypted communications paths for harvesting, say, like harvesting data off residential electric meters. Schneider does go on to say that this protocol is nearly 30 years old, and it was a different world, kinder, gentler. A new implementation has emerged that is encrypted. Now, what we need to keep in mind is that IoT world isn't new, and much of the IoT communication systems were developed in a kinder, gentler world. Heck, when we were working on the original wireless mesh system that became Zigbee, it was a DARPA project, the base protocol wasn't encrypted. Instead, we used the SSH encrypted client to move data around. Since then, many wireless IoT systems like LoRa have implemented encrypted data paths as a default implementation. So anyway, I strongly recommend reading this Dark Reading article if you are at all involved with smart meters and building or campus management systems.
There has been some exciting news in the world of space and telecommunications. Over the past 18 months, we've seen some outstanding achievements from James Webb Space Telescope's launch to Starlink's use in Ukraine. But according to this Fiber System article, a quieter event may be the biggest game changer yet. In December 2022, NASA's T-Bird mission successfully demonstrated a groundbreaking 100 gigabits per second data link for a small CubeSat-sized satellite. Unlike Starlink's 2.0's inter-satellite lasers, NASA's system can actually penetrate the atmosphere, clouds, and bad weather at a fraction of the cost with speed equal to terrestrial fiber connections. And this speed is likely to increase as the technology matures. What does that mean for us? Well, laser communications are directional, meaning they don't interface or interfere with other transmissions, requiring less complicated legislation, have lower costs, less carbon emissions, and provide enhanced security. And we can expect improved positioning systems, better uptime and reliability with satellite ground links. Now, consider the cost implications. A global constellation of these satellites would maintain terrestrial fiber speeds, reducing costs significantly. Imagine a future for high-speed Wi-Fi on a transatlantic flight or a swift internet access in disaster zones is actually a reality. Now, the breakthrough does raise some questions about regulation and protection from misuse, but if T-Bird's success can be reliably replicated, we may be on the cusp of communications revolution. So move over, Dr. Evil. It's not just about sharks with laser beams anymore, but satellites. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week, Enterprise Tech, and that's Melissa, the data quality experts. E-commerce losses to online payment fraud were estimated at $41 billion globally in 2022. Melissa ID helps organizations tackle identity fraud with an end-to-end process to safely track customer data. The biometrics verification step features an algorithm that recognizes a matchup between the user's selfie and their ID image. Using an advanced algorithm, the process analyzes over 60 facial features, including changes in facial hair, makeup, age, hairstyle, skin imperfections, and head pose. This cutting edge technology offers businesses an additional level of security and insurance that their customers are always genuine. Now, with this process, businesses can ensure that their customers are whom they claim to be, enhancing trust and credibility. The financial industry and e-commerce retailers are already using AI-powered fraud detection systems to safeguard their customers from fraud. For example, banks and credit card companies are using advanced machine learning algorithms to meticulously analyze customer data, including their purchase history and location, to identify and potentially any suspicious transactions that are out there. Plus, retailers are actually working at this as well. They're utilizing powerful AI-driven fraud detection systems to effectively prevent fraudulent orders and chargebacks, reduce risk, ensure compliance, and keep your customers happy. With Melissa's ID tools, you get the following. With the proof of life feature, it does a face scan and checks for eye movement to establish the person is real. The document verification feature captures ID and document data using machine-readable zones and optical character recognition. Document scanning to actually extract crucial information from passports, utility bills, driver's licenses, and much more. Biometrics uses smart facial recognition and facial comparison algorithms to recognize a match between a selfie and an ID image. Since 1985, Melissa has specialized in global intelligence solutions. Plus, Melissa continually undergoes independent security audits and is SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant, so you know your data is in the best hands. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the bites. Researchers at Checkpoint Research have uncovered rather devious piece of espionage malware that propagates itself via infected USB drives. I'm going to summarize this dark reading article. Now, the malware came to the forefront during an incident at a European healthcare institution, underscoring the sophistication and stealth of today's cyber threats. Now, we are no strangers to the dangers of USB drives found on the floor, whether it be Black Hat or airports. However, this elusive black backdoor malware named Wisp Rider is believed to be in the handiwork of the Chinese state-sponsored advanced threat APT group known as Camaro Dragon, but you might know them as the Mustang Panda as well. Now, the Wisp Rider threat was discovered after an employee at the healthcare institution participated in a conference in Asia. He unknowingly came home with an infected USB drive. The malware spread throughout the hospital's computer systems after using it as at his institution. Now, Mustang Panda, once primarily focused on Southeast Asia, seems to be expanding its nefarious activities worldwide here. This was confirmed when the group was found to be behind a cyber espionage campaign against the Russian military, despite China's tacit support for Russia. Now, let's get into the specifics of Wisp Rider, which was involved significantly since Avast first identified it in the last year. The malware now has the ability to spread through USB drives using a launcher named HopperTick. It cleverly includes a bypass for SMAT-AV, an antivirus solution popular in Southeast Asia, and performs a DLL side loading using components of a well-known security software and even components of gaming giants like Electronic Arts and Riot Games. Checkpoint has alerted these companies about the malware's activity. How serious is the threat, seeing that most organizations have, you know, even asked that the USB storage not be used to ensure data loss protection scenarios? That is the first question that I want to throw to my co-host here, because the fact is, USB, isn't that an old technology? What do you think, Curtis?
Well, USB is a technology that is not as common as it once was as a way of moving files around, but it's still quite common. And we also have to realize that things are not uniform across the world. We tend to think of doing things here in North America and probably in Western Europe that might not be as common in other parts of the world. In a lot of those places, a good USB stick is still a great way to move files around. And I'll be honest, I know a lot of people here in the States that use USB sticks when they're moving things like large photo or video files, things that are just cumbersome to stick somewhere online and have someone else download. So while I would say that it's declining in use, USB drives are still out there in huge, huge numbers.
Now, question for you, Chibert, because what can businesses do here to protect themselves from such a kind of, I guess you'd say, legacy threat?
Well, let's put it this way. One of the key features for almost every virtual desktop or thin desktop or whatever types of system out there where you have corporate control is being able to turn on and off USB support, USB storage support. So that's kind of, you know, broad sweeping. I am going to bring up a little bit of history here. I was at DEF CON, and one of the three-letter agencies here in America decided to try and educate the users by sprinkling random USB drives around the conference. And when people tried to stick it into their machines, it would pop them up a message saying, you've been pwned. Well, not really, but this is what could have happened. And so it was more of an education thing. It's gotten to the point where a lot of large organizations are now saying USB drives are pretty much disposable. Make sure you go and open a fresh one. You know, don't go picking it out of a big basket anymore. And I'd say they actually have taken the place of what we used to use floppies for. And the price has dropped to the point where it's almost as cheap as floppies. That is not to say that they haven't opened a new pathway. And in this case, the article actually talks about how even isolated networks, so like, for instance, power control and power plants, high security facilities and so forth are air gapped networks. And this is one way for them to go across that air gap. And I'm going to bring up one last thing. And that is, keep in mind, a lot of these nation states are into collecting grains of sand. You collect enough grains of sand and pretty soon you have your own beach. So don't let them collect the grains of sand to start with. Be careful about your USBs. I actually don't let my USBs, my work USBs, I don't let them out of my sight anymore because there's just so many things happening. And I now tend to buy really, really cheap, like 8 gig or 16 gig USB drives in bulk that are still sealed. And I throw them away after I've sent it out to someone that I don't know and trust implicitly.
Right. It's funny because they used to give these out a bunch at conferences, obviously, with a bunch of decks on them or whatnot. Now it's all cloud-based. Actually, this brings to my next question. A lot of organizations are trying to implement zero trust. They're trying to ensure data loss protection. And so they're asking users to store things on cloud storage, local storage, that kind of thing, to ensure that they can audit this type of access. And so when things are shared, they know what type of data is being, you know, ingressed and egressed. Curtis, go back to you. If a USB drive has to be used, does it really make sense? Is it makes sense in a zero trust environment? Is there really a reason for it?
USB sticks don't make sense in any sort of highly secure environment. There are just too many issues with them, and they're too difficult to control. Now, having said that, are there some somewhat expensive ways to have secure flop, you know, USB drives? Sure. But do most companies use those? No. Do any individuals use them? No. So, you know, if you are concerned with security, you find another way to deal with it. You know, as I said, the place where things get complicated is when we're dealing with very large files. I mean, if you're dealing with spreadsheets, with texts, with PowerPoint decks, things of that nature, then you can stick them in the cloud, do a secure file transfer, all kinds of things come into play. The problem exists when you have to deal with video files, big video files for editing, large graphic files, large audio files, things of that nature. And that's when you have to, as a unit, as a group, figure out some way to securely deal with those occasional large file transfers. Because if you don't, I guarantee that your users will find a way around your security. And that takes you into territory you don't want to visit.
Right. Right. Now, Cheebert, you're familiar with a lot of network technology. I can tell you from a fact, I've saw an organization just recently has a bunch of network appliances, semi-older, I'd say maybe 5 years old, that still only update via USB. What's the way to protect there if somebody has a malicious file on one of those devices?
Yeah, it actually gets worse. It's not just network devices, it's servers. In order, almost all the servers I've worked with, there's no easy way of doing a BIOS upgrade or any kind of firmware update on a server without getting a USB involved. So for that, what we did with the three-letter agencies is we would get a trusted source of USBs, typically ones that are still sealed. We'd open it. We'd make sure when we downloaded the file that we needed, we would run a hash on it. So regardless, you should be running a hash. Now, I'm not to say that this is perfect. There has been some cases where corporations got hacked back at the distributions or back at their download server. And I don't have a solution for that. But at least if it's coming straight from the company and the hash matches, and you created that USB for the upgrade, you've reduced most of the dangers. You know, insider threats are you know, all bets off. But my other thing that I used to like doing is I still use optical. Still do write once. I'll write to a CD or a DVD that can only be written that one time, and then I'll run the finish process so that it cannot be added. Not perfect, but that's how I will transfer larger files in a more trusted environment. And I will make sure I run a hash on that and use a different method to send that hash file or hash signature to the destination.
Now, one thing I find pretty interesting here, one more question to Kurt, because I find it interesting that, you know, obviously this type of threat seems to actually be targeting organizations that might not have user education around this, or maybe even have the resources or the services to protect themselves from this type of threat. So this is like the example given in the article itself was a hospital in this case. So it seems like this type of threat is targeting very specific organizations. What do you think, Kurt?
Well, that's classically what USB carried threats have done. I mean, let's all remember the infamous case of Stuxnet that ended up hitting the Iranian centrifuges because of malware carried on a USB stick that got inserted in a lab in Iran. The people most vulnerable to this kind of attack are those with a lot of technical training in the wrong areas, because that often presents a false sense of confidence about what they can get away with. I hate to say it, but many physicians fall into that category. They are highly educated, very well trained in their specialty. Does not necessarily mean that they're superb IT people. Many categories of engineers fall into the same thing. And you can go on and on. But the basic thing is that this is a category of employee. The highly trained, often highly intelligent and highly motivated individual that presents a special vulnerability for IT to deal with. And unfortunately, they are frequently the most difficult cats to herd in the right direction.
Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we have our guest. But before we get to our guest, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Miro. Let me ask you something. Are you still dealing with the annoyance of constantly switching between tabs and tools and losing important information and ideas along the way? Well, have you heard of Miro? It's the cool visual platform that combines all your work in one place, whether you're working from home or even a hybrid workspace. It's a super powerful collaboration tool that lets everyone on your team share their thoughts and make something great together. Shorten time to launch so your customers get what they need faster. With Miro, you need only one tool. See your vision come to life. Planning, researching, brainstorming, designing, and feedback cycles, it can all live on a Miro board across teams. And faster input means faster outcomes. In fact, Miro users report the tool increasing project delivery speed by 29%. Miro also allows you to effortlessly view and share the bigger picture. When everyone has access to the same information and voice, your team is always engaged, invested, satisfied, and most importantly, happy. Additionally, using Miro's templates like the swim lane diagram can help you avoid confusions regarding responsibilities, processes, roles, and even timelines. Strategic planning becomes easier when it's visual and accessible. Tap into a way to map processes, systems, and plans with the whole team so they not only view it, have a chance to give feedback as well. If you're feeling meeting fatigue, I know I am. Miro users report saving up to 80 hours per user per year just from streamlining conversations and feedback. Ready to be part of the more than 1 million users who join Miro every month? Get your first three boards for free to start working better together at Miro.com miro.com/podcast. That's miro.com/podcast. And we thank Miro for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Rye. And today we have Lenley Hensley. He's Chief Product Officer of Aerospike. Welcome to the show, Hensley. Lenley.
Hey there. Glad to be here with you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So we, you know, before we get into the show, our audience is a large spectrum of experiences. They, whether they're entry level all the way up to CTOs, CEOs, and a lot of them like to hear people's basically origin stories. Can you take us through a journey through tech and what brought you to Aerospike?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, in terms of my own origin story, you know, I'm a retread. They didn't have computer science departments back when I started. I started in economics, and we were one of the groups that, you know, made models on computers that filled floors of buildings, and had about, you know, a quarter of the compute that, you know, you've got in your phone, if that, right? And I came back and retooled at one point and got into financial software, and then got over onto the system software side where I'm at now at Aerospike. And I've sort of played the game from all sides. A lot of time, you know, typing code, a lot of time managing large engineering organizations, and a lot of time getting on the business side, right? Because, you know, as we progress, that inevitably happens. Now I'm Chief Product Officer and, you know, drive our product direction at Aerospike.
Fascinating. So I think one thing that I, you know, we definitely should get into it because this is a very interesting topic. Parallel computing and data processing is essentially sometimes the holy grail for some specific organizations. Very challenging to get there, get it right, and scale well. Can you maybe share some examples of maybe organizations that might benefit from combining those two things?
So I think that, you know, I'll use an example of a customer we have who spoke at our summit conference yesterday, Guy Dasa at Dataminer. And Dataminer looks at over 50,000 data feeds, you know, simultaneously ingesting huge amounts of data and then developing alerts about things that are happening in the world, you know. And what we see now in enterprises is both people using internal data and what I call global contextual data, right? And many, many data sources, right? So when you have that many data sources, just the ingestion becomes a problem. And you want to pull it all into the same place. You want to capture it effectively, meaning, you know, not drop any on the floor. You know, you capture all the transactions coming in, all the data, and you need to put it to use as soon as you can, right? And that means that you have to put a lot of processing and a lot of data movement in parallel at the same time. So we're a distributed database, truly distributed. You know, we both scale up, scale out, and that means you can put a lot of different processors going against things, but we also write our code so that we're, you know, able to handle millions of transactions per second. We have people doing 12 billion transactions a day. And the only way to do that, you know, in a cost-efficient way is with commodity hardware, commodity instance types, you know, in the cloud, and put them at work in parallel, acting as one, you know, concerted group handling the workload, right? And that's really what clustering algorithms are about. And we really focus on those things and being efficient.
So that gets me to my next question, because obviously you're using some interesting algorithms. Can you maybe share just a little bit about some of the technology you're using in order to do this, and even at such a small scale of resources requirements?
Yeah, so I'll tackle this from two standpoints. One is that, and this is one of our key secret sauces, right? What we have is the ability to, for a given server, project down the data workload over 36 terabytes and operate on it as if it were memory. So we use SSDs in a different way. We don't go through the file system. We don't go through the operating system. We write directly to the NVMe, you know, driver, and then we treat it like blocks of memory. and are able to do that in a massively parallel way with multiple, you know, IO channels. And that allows us to use fewer servers to cover a given workload. I'll give you an example. We did a benchmark set up with AWS and Intel for a petabyte data set and did it with 20 servers.
Well, I've got to ask, with those 20 servers, are you essentially striping the data across them? Or are you doing something a bit more sophisticated using some sort of other architecture for the data?
Yeah, so great question, Kurt. So we're not really striping the data. We divide it up into 4,096 partitions. We shard it out. You don't have to shard it. We do it based on a hashing algorithm. We also constantly adjust that. We have load balancing algorithms going on all the time in the background, and we're redistributing that data. And that partitioning algorithms, it's a roster-based scheme for clustering rather than a quorum-based. A lot of people go like, how are you able to do this? And we have to then explain, oh, wait, you're thinking it's a quorum-based model. It's not. But we're a roster-based model, and that allows us to give higher availability. But if we lose a node in a cluster, we can then have replication factors that allow us to go find all the partitions that have the same data and then rebalance and reform the cluster. And so you'll never even know what happened. We have people who, you know, are online, and they may have, you know, 50, you know, 100 nodes, and they'll lose a few because of the vagaries of the cloud, if you know what I mean about that. And then it just keeps on working, and then they'll come back and replace those nodes later and just suffer zero downtime and really almost no performance impact.
Now, I wanted to ask, because you talked when you were answering an earlier question about the number of transactions that some of your customers have in a given day. So do you position yourself as a pure OLTP engine, or does your architecture allow you to be accessible as and useful on a commercial basis as an analytics engine as well?
So I'll give you a nuanced answer to that, Kurt. So you know, by and large, we sort of position ourselves as an operational database, which really, you know, speaks to the OLTP side. So unlike a lot of NoSQL databases, we are strongly consistent. So we support linearizable reads, you know, and are able to be strongly consistent with transaction rates that, you know, remain up into the millions per second. And the other side of it, though, is that we are used quite often to drive machine learning, because we'll ingest all this data, and we're able to do that because we support mixed workloads really well. High write rates, but also high read rates and high mixed workload rates. So as stuff comes in, and when you're talking about real-time workloads, if you have to move the data around to do, you know, some level of training or learning, then you lose time. And so being able to operate in place and then also write the features back into the same data store and have them accessible for queries, if you will, you know, and that's used a lot in fraud situations, in identity management situations, and that tightening that loop is a big benefit.
I know that there are some of the operational databases out there that get their performance, especially when it comes to doing things like ad hoc queries and other things sent to against the data, by sucking vast amounts into a truly horrifically expensive blob of memory, so that you're doing in-memory transactions as much as possible. Now, does your architecture let you provide the performance without having to write a nine-figure check for vast quantities of memory?
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of solutions that sort of claim the same things we do, as you said, their in-memory solutions. And DRAM, as you point out, has a tax on it. You know, it's more expensive. So as I said, we're using NVMe SSD space to extend. So what we do is we put our indexing in memory. This is our hybrid memory architecture, and then all of the data on SSDs. So where and we're able to get access to a piece of data in a single hop from the client, because the client also, you know, the application is a first class participant in the cluster architecture. It has the roster as well. Okay. And then the other thing is that with the, with going to NVMe, we are doing that access to data in single digit to even sub millisecond latency as if it were memory. And we can do that across data sizes from gigabytes up to petabytes because of this partitioning algorithm that we have and because of the roster-based solution that we have, that the client can understand where to find that piece of data, you know, in one hop.
Well, I know that my colleague Brian has a whole set of questions he's waiting to ask, but I've got one more, and I hate to say it, I'm you know, putting on my analyst hat here. As you say, I am familiar with some of these other databases, and many of them are tied to large enterprise applications, specifically something like SAP HANA. So you are not tied directly to any specific enterprise application. Who would you see, or what technologies do you tend to see as your competition? I mean, who do you find yourself when you go to a customer, or when a customer comes to you?
Yeah.
Who do they say they're comparing you to?
So I'll say this, that a certain portion of our business is brownfield, you know, replacement of technology. And so people on Cassandra might have, you know, 2,000, 2,500 nodes, right? It scales out marvelously, is what I'll say. And they just go, you know, it becomes unmanageable. And those nodes, as we were talking about, you know, to get the latency, they're using higher DRAM ratios and it becomes expensive. And so we'll replace something like that with, you know, 250 or 400 nodes. Okay. And that's something we see over and over again, both with Cassandra, with Couch. We had a customer, Criteo in France, that's a large edtech customer that was using Couchbase. They were able to cut the number of nodes they had for those workloads down enough to close more than one data center that they had.
Well, wow. Okay, so first off, there's a person in the chat room. He's not saying his name or her name. Apparently, they used to work for you back in 2001 in the Denver office as a Unix platform manager for JDE. And they're just doing a
hello. JD Edwards, you bet. Yeah.
So my question actually is, real-time platforms are spectacular. And there's all kinds of things you can do with them, but they tend to create a decent amount of data. How are you going, you know, information overload in any real-time system gets to be a real problem. I dealt a lot with the military, and that was one of the big problems of a lot of the real-time systems we used. How do you propose we start dealing with that as more and more systems start coming online?
So we see an interesting pattern in what customers are doing. You know, these days we learn as much from our customers as they learn from us, right? And so we call it an edge and core deployment model. And so the edge might be hundreds of terabytes, and it's what's keeping data maybe up to a month. And then they'll simultaneously, through our change data capture, be filtering that data back over to a cluster that might be multiple petabytes. And there, that remains historical context data, because sometimes, right, you don't know when you're going to need certain access to certain data. So they'll go through and they'll say, didn't find him here. Now we're going to go back to the core, if you will, and they find it, and then they can use it there, or they can pull it back. Okay. And the other thing I'll say is that we're kind of an interesting, because that brings up the caching question, right, to some extent. So we're not used as a cache as much as we are as a twinning of system, that this is the real-time thing. And you know, we are used in financial services sometimes for intraday systems of record. Okay, so it's all real-time. But then they'll filter it back over to a mainframe that keeps all that historical data. And that allows them to offer different levels of service, right? We've all seen the thing where you deposit money and you want it to show up like not 3 days later, not a day later, not hours later, but right then, right? And they're able to do that type of thing. But then all the regulatory stuff, all the, you know, accounting stuff winds up being handed off somewhere else.
Well, I'll tell you what, your PR group was very nice to send us some of your references, like PayPal, Wayfair, Adobe, Airtel, and others. Instead of asking you to break faith with them, why don't we go and ask you more? You're obviously not our father's database. What kinds of things is your system appropriate for? And how do you plan for this? You know, what's involved with putting together the bricks and mortar to use a real-time system like this?
Yeah, so in terms of generalized use cases, right, there are a couple. You know, I mentioned that we are a transaction capture point. So, you know, for real-time capture and making that available, right, so that other people in a firm can see it and take action on it. And we have change data notification capabilities that can let people know this data has changed. We can push it out to a different application and everything. But setting up, you know, it's less than about real time than a truly distributed system is a different game. And people have to think of it differently, right? People are trained with things like Postgres that, you know, we have a server, and then we have a high availability backup, if you will, right? And when you say, here's my data, which node is it on? In ours, it might be moving around, you know, moving from one place to the next, right? And so I think that's something that people have to understand, and we manage all of that as opaquely as possible is what I'll say, that they don't have to follow that. In terms of just real-time use cases, I think that feature stores, right? We all talk about AI ML a lot now, and features are generated. But the question is, you don't get value from AI ML until those features are deployed back to the edge and used for decisioning in real time. And used for decisioning at scale is the other thing we see. And this notion of at scale, you know, I mentioned we do, you know, 12 billion transactions a day. But when you talk about using multiple features, you know, hundreds of features, you know, a terabyte of features to solve a decisioning problem, but you have 20 to 40 milliseconds to do that without creating friction in our interaction between the person and the system, you have to really do things quickly. And that's where we excel.
Okay, so since we're talking about responding within, you know, let's ask the question. I'd like you to polish up your crystal ball a little bit. Everybody and their uncle's going crazy over AI and how it's going to affect different industries. And it occurs to me one of the things that happens is being able to respond quickly in, say, the financial world, where milliseconds or make a huge difference. Is this something you folks are going to look at? And is this something that you see as appropriate for the type of work you folks do?
Yeah, it is. And I'll say we've been on a journey in some sense, right? We started out just being a key value store. We added documents. We just announced support for graph data models and graph processing. But the key thing that we sustain across all these is to do it in a way that scales both in terms of throughput and in size and amounts of data applied. Okay. And when you talk about what's going on in AI ML right now with generative AI, it's great, right? We can all go play with ChatGPT and it's kind of amazing, right? But then when you think about applying it in a business, it comes down to being able to apply the vectors that are generated in the learning systems that you now have access to and applying them quickly at the edge, which means that you have to be able to do, you know, proximity searches with hierarchical navigable small worlds, they call it. I love that, actually, you know, but HNSW. But it's a different search algorithm, and it's going to require the same types of applications of making use of parallelism in the hardware, being able to get access to data. You know, those vectors are essentially multi-dimensional, you know, arrays that are flattened out. You have to be able to pull that back and find those elements and get through all those computations very quickly. So, you know, when you ask something in ChatGPT, it's sort of typing at a given speed and it's cranking along. But when you're talking about doing a trade, it's going to be something that has to be applied really quickly. And we think it's the same problem, just an extension of the work we've done with the typical features that are applied coming out of machine learning today.
All right. So your PR group sent me an interesting little tidbit. And they're talking about how you folks are proud of helping reduce people's carbon footprint. And doesn't feel like it's intuitive, but obviously there's a story there. And why don't you share that?
Yeah. So you know, we talked about being able to use commodity hardware and use fewer servers, right? I said, you know, somebody might be using, you know, 2,500 servers and we would replace it with, you know, 200 or 300, right? And that's a savings in electricity and all of the different, you know, materials that go into making a computer. And as we, you know, look at an AI-driven future, right, it means that more and more data is going to be applied and more computation. And being able to do that efficiently and effectively with a minimum use of hardware to accomplish a given task becomes ever more important. So we published a paper coming out of work we did with Amazon when we ported our solution to Graviton, right, to their ARM processors, because ARM processors save energy. That's the big key. They're faster, but the faster and being able to do more computations isn't the big thing. They just use way less energy. And using fewer servers in combination with something like an ARM chip that uses less power means that you don't need as much electricity. And it's significant. Think about that. 2,500 servers, you know, to 300, something like that. You're going to save money, too. Save money, too. You know, it's like I worked with Larry Ellison at Oracle, and, you know, he would say, is this bamboo stuff? Is it green? And sometimes I would say, it's green in two ways, Larry.
Nice. All right. So all our viewers are going to want to know, what kinds of homework should they be doing before they give you folks a call? And how do they reach out to you to get more information about Aerospike?
Well, to get more information about Aerospike, you know, it's www.aerospike.com. And we have a developer hub, so Dev Hub. And the Dev Hub has forums, which we monitor, where you can ask questions about, you know, I've got an application, I'm thinking about, you know, trying to speed it up, or I'm trying to use more data to get a higher fidelity result in a decisioning system. and they can see what's going on there and get answers there. And that's where I think they should go there. And what was the first part of your question?
What kinds of things should people ask themselves? Yeah. What's the homework?
So I think it's like this. You know, a lot of this comes from data scientists and the overall system. So we see over and over again where there's this conflict between the people doing the data science and the people doing the data engineering, if you will. Okay. And they say, can we make the results better? You know, you mentioned that, you know, Wayfair is a customer, right? And they were able to get, you know, very real benefits to the cart size by applying not, you know, a few hundred megabytes, even gigabytes, not even terabytes, but they said if we could apply 30 terabytes each time in generating the add-on recommendations to a cart, then we could make a material difference rather than what the developers and the operations people were saying. And when they went to Aerospike, they said, you know what, we can do that. We can do that now and get a different result. So you really need to know what you're looking for. And the basic thing is that, you know, applying more data in a given, you know, time-bound SLA, service level agreement, yields a higher fidelity result from a higher fidelity model. And it translates into actual dollars for people. But if you don't clearly think that through, you know, you can spend a lot of money, you can do a lot of work, and you may not get the financial results you expect.
Oh, okay. So I get to blame you guys for that extra little things that Wayfair throws in my basket saying, you really want this, don't you?
I will say that, you know, many of my friends, that's the way they characterize my work. Oh, you're the guy who does that. There's more to it.
I tell you, we are having all kinds of fun, and I was really and truly hoping some of our viewers would have more questions other than hi. But where do you see Aerospike going in the future? Are you willing to speculate on what other things it can be used for? Where is that golden fleece that you're looking for?
Yeah, I think that, as I said, it's a continuation of the path we've been on. You know, we've been helping people do trades in ad tech bidding. We've been helping people capture trades in, you know, stock brokerages to do models for risk analysis and things and apply more data to a given problem and do it more quickly, right? And as we look at the AI future, it's more of the same. I mean, one of the most interesting articles I've read was in the Financial Times about the cost of generative AI and what a difference, like two more percentages, you know, go from 5%, you know, for loans to 7%, and all of a sudden the cost of money goes up. And can anybody afford the farms of servers that are required to actually drive that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that being able to do that more efficiently just matters. So we think about trying to do this stuff that needs to be done as at low cost and efficient and within time-bound SLAs, because getting the answer later makes a huge difference than getting the answer now, right? And the based on the context that's now. I sometimes joke about our business that we're all in here, you know, Brian, you know, Kurt. We've been trying to catch up to the present forever, right? It used to be you go look at your warehouse and know something from, you know, a month ago. And now we're just getting closer and closer to being able to make decisions based upon data that's current and being able to make decisions in the moment as well. And I think that's what we're focused on, and the algorithms change and it just needs more data. And we're going to be there with vector database support and proximity searches and things like that.
Well, I'm going to go and ask one last question, and that's scaling. Right now, you're hitting some fairly, it sounds like some fairly large organizations, but are we ever going to see this type of decision-making tool? Because that's what it is. It's a tool. Start getting smaller, more towards the edge. You know, I can imagine things like, gee, it'd be great if some of these algorithms were, say, in point of sale for add-on stuff. Or it could be in a hotel booking system saying, well, you've got this, you've booked this type of room, but for just a few dollars more, you can go this way. It's all decision-making tools and trying to do things quicker instead of letting the customer walk away. Do you see your industry doing that one of these days?
So I think we do that now, you know, through the wonders of the internet and the increasing speeds of the internet, where it's all happening maybe back up in the cloud or back up in a data center, but being interacted with at the edge. We're also seeing this, that we work with, you know, Amazon and Google and others, and people are making devices that will hold, I don't know, 36 terabytes, you know, on the order of that, with a fair amount of compute in a ruggedized fashion that can be deployed in like an oil field and, you know, in a battlefield, you know, wherever, right? And then capture data there, make it available even when it's not connected, and run those same decisioning algorithms, you know, like push the features to it and add new data to it in place, and then still reach back over whatever satellite technology, you know, and get replenished and provide its data back upstream too. It's important to note that, you know, it's not just one cluster. The way data works these days is data's in motion all the time. It's being refreshed continuously. You know, we had a customer in a conversation one time tell me that, you know, the difference between the past and the present in management of data is that we used to think about using huge amounts of compute against huge amounts of data that was old. Now we think about recognizing patterns as they come across and taking action based on them right then with the data in motion, because data is old, you know, milliseconds afterwards.
Fabulous. You know, it's been fun. And our audience agrees. You've been a spectacular guest. Thank you so very much for your time and ideas. I think it's time to start winding up this show and say thank you. And we'd like you to say goodbye. And where can people get more information? Do you want to have people reach out to you if they have more questions?
You bet. So, you know, as I said, our website's www.aerospike.com, and you can reach me at Elhen Sarling, LHENSARLING, at aerospike.com.
Thanks a lot. You know, Mr. Liu had to beat feet because he had prior commitments, so he wasn't able to stay through the whole show, but we had a great time talking to Lindley Henserling, Chief Product Officer of Aerospike, and we'd love to hear your ideas. So I happen to be Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T at twit.tv. I'm also on Twitter. I start bragging about all kinds of cool things that I'm tinkering with. I happen to be ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, on Twitter. You're also welcome to throw email to twiat@twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. We'd love to hear your ideas and so forth. Now, I am going to do one last thing, just because this is coming up to the, you know, we're heading towards the 4th of July. I had a public service announcement that was requested by a nonprofit company called Vitalent, and is urging all eligible donors to schedule a blood donation this July. Blood donations the week surrounding the 4th of July typically drop by 2,000 or more and are among the lowest of the summer season. But the blood supply must continue to be replenished as emergency surgeries, treatments for blood disorders, and cancer therapies that use blood can't take a break for the holidays. Type O blood is the most transfused blood. Type O negative can be used to help any patient in an emergency, and O positive can help any patient with a positive blood type. Platelet donations are also constantly needed for cancer patients, open heart surgeries, and transplants. Platelets must be used within a week of donation. As a special thank you, donors who come to give July 1 through 7 will receive an exclusive Vitalant cooler redeemable by email. Those who give between July 8th and 22 will receive a San Francisco Giants blood donor t-shirt. Learn more and make an appointment to give at Vitalant, spelled Vitalant.org, and so forth. Now, I will point out this is in the Bay Area. However, the need for blood is worldwide, and especially during big holidays. Sadly, some people drink and drive, and that causes a spike in the need for blood. So in your local community, help the people around you. Help yourself. Give blood. It's worth doing. Mr. Curtis, you've got all kinds of projects going on.
I do indeed. Most of mine, when I get back from vacation, are going to revolve around getting ready for some travel that I have to do. I'm going to be going to a vendor conference in mid-July, and I'm getting ready for my presentation at the Omdia Analyst Summit, which is part of Black Hat. I'm going to be in Las Vegas in August. I'll be at Black Hat. I'll also be at DEF CON. And as always, I'd love to see members of the Twilight Riot if you're going to be at any of those in real time, real space. If you're not, or even if you are, feel free to hit me up. I'm on Twitter at KG4GWA. I'm on Mastodon, KG4GWA, at mastodon.sdf.org. On LinkedIn, Curtis Franklin, please follow me at any of those and feel free to send me a direct message. Love to hear from you. Love to know what you are interested in hearing us talk about right here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Well, if you're watching the live show, why don't you also join the chat room at irc.twit.tv? You know, you can also find the subscribe and download links at twit.tv/twit, something to share with your friends. But don't forget about Club Twit. For ad-free content and access to our members-only Discord channel that starts at $7 a month, you can find out more at twit.tv/clubtwit. Well, thanks for watching, and for next time, just keep twit.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.